those who know your name will put their trust in you. For you, Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you. Pastor Miller?
If I invite you to turn to Daniel chapter 1, you might wonder what I'm doing with Bible prophecies. Well, we're going to do something different this morning than just Bible prophecies. In Daniel 1, you remember, he and his friends were challenged as to what they were willing to eat and drink and what they were not willing to eat and drink. But notice how Daniel dealt with it. For he purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Daniel made a decision in his heart and life that he was going to stay by. He didn't tell the king, your diet is worthless, I don't want it. He didn't rebel or anything. He made a decision. And then if you go on to chapter 2 of Daniel, you will remember that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, couldn't figure out what it was or what it meant. And finally, Daniel came and was able to help solve the problem. Daniel answered the king, "Blessed be the name of God forever." When he was able to give what that dream meant, the king, wow, this was great. Daniel didn't take the credit. He said, "Blessed be the God forever." Because it was God that gave the information, not Daniel. And then you go to chapter 3 of Daniel. And that's when Daniel's three friends had a challenge. The Bible does not tell us why Daniel wasn't involved at this point. But the king had this great image made, and he wanted everybody to bow down and worship it. And after all, the king is in charge, and he is to be worshipped according to the situation, according to the practice, the life, the style of those days. And the king said to these three worthies, "Who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Is there any God bigger than what I can do?" And you remember their response. "We don't have to answer you in this matter. Our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace." Absolute confidence and trust that God can do that. And they even went further. "If perchance he chooses not to do that, we still will not worship your idol. We will worship the God of heaven." And then it goes on to chapter 4. And this was the one where the king got challenged. When the king had proclaimed all of this area, "I have done this." And Daniel had told him about his dream and what would happen. The king really didn't want to hear what Daniel had to say. Daniel told him about the dream after thinking about it a bit, because what the dream said, Daniel did not want to have to tell the king. This was significant when you stop and consider the king, the one in charge of everything for the whole society. Everything he says goes, and Daniel is going to tell him, you're going to become worthless. Now, that wasn't something he wanted to tell the king. And he was astonished. And it says that his thoughts troubled him. Daniel was very much troubled by what he knew he had to say. But finally he says, may the dream concern those who hate you, and its interpretation concern your enemies. Daniel didn't want this to happen to the king. Let it happen to somebody else, but not to you. Well, finally, when what Daniel had told the king was going to be the interpretation of the dream, and it happened exactly as Daniel had told him it would happen. And finally, the king came back to his senses and realized the significance of what had happened and what Daniel had said. The king said, I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. Notice in each case, each chapter in Daniel up to this point, God was exonerated and honored. Every time God's people didn't take any credit for themselves, they gave the honor and the glory to the God of heaven. And God, he is in charge in everything. How strong is your dependence upon God for whatever goes on in your life? When things happen that you have no control over, how do you deal with them? Back in the early 1950s, I was in Korea. And I made the trip many times, going out of the city of Seoul and went out to the east side, northeast part of the city of Seoul. And you turn off to the right, and there's a road that turns and goes up and makes a circle and then comes back down. And up at the top is the Seoul Sanitarium and Hospital, a building about three stories high where they took care of everything they could take care of. And in 1950, they were startled because the North Korean army started coming south, and they knew they were in for trouble. And like happens other buildings, there was a way of a stairway that would go up to the roof of the hospital. And so a bunch of the staff went up to the roof, and they could look out toward the north, and they could see the North Korean army coming south. And they saw the situation, and it would be easy to say, let's run and get out of here. But they didn't do that. the nurses that were up there looked and said, look, there's going to be people needing medical help. When you have this kind of a thing go on, you know people are going to get hurt. And so we're going to stay and do what we can to help the people. And there were others of the staff that did that, particularly Mr. Kim, the treasurer. He says, with the war coming, I don't know what I can do. There's not much you do with the treasury when you got war. But whatever, I'm staying too. And I'll do what I can. Well, it didn't take long for the North Korean army to come down and take over the area. And when they got to the hospital, they took the South Korean flag down, put up the North Korean flag, and they told them, they said, you take care of whoever comes in and needs your help. And they basically said to themselves, that's what we were going to do anyway, so it doesn't matter. And so they kept busy. I don't know just how long after the war got started that this took place, but I don't think it was very long afterwards that the people were busy at the hospital, and this North Korean army truck came up the road, up in front of the hospital, and parked. And North Korean army officer came up, and he saw person in charge. He says, I want all your nurses out here on the front. Well, when he's the officer and he's got the gun, you do what he says. And so they brought the nurses out. There's a sidewalk there right alongside the road, and these nurses lined up on that sidewalk. And without explanation of what's going on or anything, the officer told the nurses, who counted down 14 nurses, and he told them to get in the truck. Now, this truck is like a U.S. Army 2.5-ton truck with a canvas cover over the back of it and stuff, and these nurses were told to get in there. And the officers didn't explain what was happening. They got in the truck and drove off. Well, Mr. Kim was concerned. He wanted to know what's happening to our nurses. And he didn't have anything. He had no transportation available except his 2 feet. And so he walked down the road, and when you get to the bottom of the road, you turn left if you're going into Seoul, and he saw that's the way the truck went. Well, by the time he got to the corner there and looked down the road, the truck was quite a ways down in front of him. He couldn't follow it. He couldn't keep up with it. But he knew what direction it went. It went toward Seoul. And so he started going toward Seoul. Well, he wasn't the only one going toward Seoul. There were hundreds of people that were running, trying to get away from the army and trying to get away from the communists and getting out of the way. There was something else going on too, and it wasn't nice, because the communist aircraft were coming in and flying over that road, and as they dove down, their guns were strafing the people. Of course, the people realized that this was going when they heard the planes coming in, and so what did they do? They headed for the ditches or anything they could do to get out of the way. It was more than once when the planes had flown off that Mr. Kim was the only one that got up and walked away. And finally, he got down towards Seoul. Well, the city of Seoul originally had actually 8 gates around the original wall of the city. Now, by this time, there was no need for the gates because there was no wall anymore, but the gates were still there. They were still part of the decoration of the city. And Mr. Kim wasn't sure what gate to go through. which direction to go, because that truck had been long ahead of him. He didn't know which way it went. But he prayed, and he chose a gate and went through. And he ended up getting to the Han River. Now, the Han River is a big river. That river is a city block wide. When I was there in the winter, when it gets cold, and it gets cold in Korea, in the I was up on a rise just a little ways above the level of the river, and I could look down, and I saw ice skaters, a big loop of them, going across the width of the river, and it was thick with people ice skating there, and that ice held them up fine. Give you a little idea of the situation. But the North Korean army had gotten to the river, and a river, a bridge, those are very critical things when it comes to military action. And so they put guards there. There were guards at the bridge that crosses the river. And those guards stopped everybody that came wanting to go across the river. And when the people came and stopped, they talked to them. It was not important information that they were talking about. It was just something to get them to talk. Because in Korea, just like in America and other places, the people speak with different accents. The people in North Korea speak with a different accent than the people in South Korea. And they knew this. And so they just wanted to get the people to talk so that they could hear that accent. If these were South Koreans that were trying to get away, they were the enemy. And they were just shot right on the spot there at the bridge. If they were North Koreans and they were going south, they were turncoats. And so they decided they were going to prolong the process with them just a little bit. And if they were North Koreans, they put them in a line. And after that line got as long as they wanted it to get, they put some officers or in charge of the line, and they marched the line down the road. And they'd march it down the road for a little bit and stop the line, and then they would shoot the last person in line. And then they'd go down the road a little further and stop and shoot the last person in line. And it came to where Mr. Kim was the last person in line, because he was from North Korea. He had that accent. And he was the last person in line. And the line stopped. And the officer was ready to shoot when somebody coming down over the hill that was right there yelled, "Don't stop! Don't shoot that man!" And they figured, well, maybe he'll do a better job than we're doing. And so this man came down over the hill, and he took Mr. Kim off over the hill. And after he had gone off over the hill, down the other side, out of sight, out of the area completely, the only one that was walking was Mr. Kim. The one that had gotten him out of sight was gone. Mr. Kim's angel was back in heaven. So Mr. Kim went on. And another thing does happen when you get war in a country. any foreigners need to get out of the way, need to leave there. Not just to save your own head, but to make it easier on the locals. It's harder on them if you stay. And so the American missionaries that had been there, they were gone, and Koreans had been taken the jobs that they had. And we had a South Korean gentleman there as the president of the work in South Korea. And so Mr. Kim went to the house. He knew where they lived, and he wanted to talk to the conference president. And he got to the house, and the man himself was not there. His wife was there. And so Mr. Kim told her what had happened about these nurses. And he says, I'm wondering where they might be. Have you seen anything? Have you noticed anything anywhere that would answer this? Well, she says, the only thing I've noticed is up on the hill above the house here a little ways, I've seen that there's putting a field hospital in up there. Oh, they are. He looked up there. And then he said, does your husband have one of those little bags for a Bible and a hymn book that ministers carry? Well, yes. He says, I don't need the Bible or the hymn book. I just need the bag, please. And then he said, do you have a white sheet I could have? Well, she brought something out, and he put a hole in it, and he pulled it down over himself, and he got a belt and pulled it around, and he had this bag. And Mr. Kim walked up the hill to that hospital. And as he got up there, there was a guard walking back and forth in front of the hospital. And he saw an officer there. The officer saw him coming. He kind of pushed the guard to one side, and he says, welcome, come right in, doctor. And Mr. Kim was ushered in, and he was put in front of a patient. And he looked at the situation, and he said, I need a nurse to help me. Do you have a nurse? Well, yes. And so they sent a nurse out. She recognized Mr. Kim. Mr. Kim recognized her. And through God's inspiration, he realized what needed to happen. And she whispered to him all day, as they did work on one patient after another that would be brought in. Whatever needed to be done, they did it. And finally, at the end of the day, Mr. Kim had the nurse come with him out to the front of the hospital, and he had a paper, and he wrote a note, made it obvious that he was writing a note. He gave it to her, and he said, will you please take this note down to the bottom of the hill? And so she went to the bottom of the hill, and he stayed. The next morning, when Mr. Kim got up and got out to do some more work with patients, he looked and he says, I need a nurse. And out came another nurse that recognized Mr. Kim, and Mr. Kim knew who she was. And the same thing happened that day. And he, at the end of the day, sent her to the bottom of the hill with a note. And this process went on every day for 14 days. Every nurse was gone. And when the 14th nurse had left, Mr. Kim said to himself, I don't need to stay here any longer, and he left also. Interesting human side panel to this is many years ago now at a camp meeting, I saw a man who was from the General Conference who dealt with foreign missions and foreign missionaries and stuff. And I spoke to him, told him a little bit about this story. He said, oh, yes, I know about that. He says, let me tell you the sequel to that. Mr. Kim came back to America, and he went back to college and became a doctor. Well, that was interesting. But notice what happens. These people depended on God. They didn't fight, quote, the enemy. They depended totally on God and His guidance in their lives. I'm going to take time to tell you one more story before we go. A man by the name of Wisdom. Wisdom was born and raised in Nazareth, the same place where Jesus was raised. And Wisdom came from a Jewish family, but a very prominent family in Nazareth, a leading family in Nazareth. Now, there's an interesting factor in Israel. Some towns are Jewish. They're Hebrew and everything. Other towns are not. They are Muslim. And it's different way. And that's, if you know about Jerusalem, Jerusalem's divided four ways because different parts of it are different religious backgrounds. Well, Nazareth is Muslim. And Wisdom's family are Muslim. Now, an interesting aspect with the Muslims, too, you know, they cannot use capital punishment for any kind of need they might have. Absolutely. That is, they cannot use the ordinary thing, maybe taking them out to a firing line and shooting them or whatever. Can't do that. No, if there's capital punishment, they have two things they could do. They can stone them. Remember, the Bible talks about stoning. Well, they can do that. Or they can use a knife. Stabbing. That's available to them, whichever they choose. Wisdom had a sister that had left the Nazareth area, that she went on over into another part of Europe and went to a university there to study. And she had become a Christian. And Wisdom found out about it. And he was concerned. Because this is not right. See, a lot of people that are professing Christians, among things that they may do that Jewish people don't go for, and the Muslims wouldn't either, and that's the eating of pork and the drinking of alcoholic beverages. And that's an absolute no-no with the Muslims. And if you're a Christian, you probably do that, so that's a no-no to you, too. And that's the way the Muslims think about it. And so when he found out that his sister had become a Christian, he called the family council and said, this is what's happened. What should we do? An uncle said, Wisdom, you must go kill your sister. He didn't tell her how, tell Wisdom how to do it. He said, you must go do it. Well, Wisdom took that as an obligation that he had to keep. He had to go do it. So he traveled to the area where she was. The only problem he had, he had her phone number, but he did not have her address. He didn't know how to find where she was. So when he got into the area, he used the phone, called up, and talked to her and told her. And he told her, he says, I have come to kill you. Just like that. Now stop and think about it. If you were told that I've come to kill you, how are you going to react to that kind of information? It's kind of rough. She was very calm and peaceful. And she said, okay, I understand. Please give me 1 year. Wait just 1 year, and then you can do it. And also she suggested that he could go to a university there to study German, because that would be helpful to him. Well, Wisdom got the idea, this would be great, because then I can go there and I can help these Christians into the right religion. I can convince them. And so that'll be a good thing. So he agreed with her that he would do that, and he went to this university. There are two things about the university that he didn't know. Number one, it was a Seventh-day Adventist university, a Christian university. Number two, that his sister had a boyfriend at that university, and her boyfriend was an Adventist pastor. He didn't know those two things at that point. Well, he was there for the year with his training and everything. And by the time the year was up, Wisdom's life had been totally changed. And he had been baptized as an Adventist Christian. Then he went back home to Nazareth, and he called a family council, and he said, I need to know something. There's in the Quran, there's this mention about this Jesus. Who is he? What's going on here? And some of them said, wait a minute, what's happened to you? And they found out, they realized that he had become a Christian. And so while they were there at their family council, an uncle who was in charge of things said, stone him. And right there, they were throwing stones at him. They had stoned him enough that he had become unconscious. But his father, who was there, had said to one of his brothers, he said, go protect him. And so he went and just laid on Wisdom and protected him from the stones. And then finally they got him off to the medical help, and after 3 or 4 days or so in the hospital, he was healed up somewhat from his injuries. And it wasn't long later that he went through that same thing again, but survived it. And they just weren't sure what they were going to do with him. Well, there was some real concern there as to how they should deal with him. And he had some cousins that were extremely upset at him and this whole thing. And they were ready to get rid of him. To the point where when they were together one time, they came up, and one of them came up behind with a big butcher knife and came up behind with him and rammed the knife into him. Now, you take a look at that. If that knife goes into that, that goes pretty much all the way through. And they stabbed with him. Except it didn't work that way. Because I don't know if this knife, I looked at the blade on this. This came out of the social hall over here. I looked at the blade on it. Didn't tell me for sure, but stainless steel knives will not bend. They will break. This knife, stainless steel knife, that they used to stab Wisdom, bent in a horseshoe shape. And the man who was holding it, when he saw that, dropped it, and someone else picked it up and said, "That's what you have with the man of God." Well, they weren't sure what they were going to do, how they were going to deal with it. One of his cousins later said, "Wisdom, you will not know how or when or where, but I will kill you." And Wisdom didn't flinch on it a bit. But sometime later, that cousin and another cousin were out riding a motorcycle, and they came around a corner and ran head-on into the front of a truck. One of them was killed outright at the scene, and the other one died about a week later in the hospital from the injuries. By this time, Wisdom's father had passed away, his uncle had passed away, but these two cousins, their lives ended. So Wisdom ended up actually coming to America. He came to Tennessee, he went to the university there. He took theology. He met a lovely young lady that's actually from South Africa, and they married. They've pastored a number of churches in Europe, and then were sent to pastor in Nazareth to share God's message of love and truth. Friends, these people show us that we can stand faithful to God under all circumstances. It doesn't matter what people do and threaten. What matters is showing God's love in every regard. We'll sing hymn number 554 to close with.